welcome back to Your Ball Was Out podcast by Phil from Tweenerhead Tennis. Today we have Scott from the Payers and Players podcast, and their podcast focuses on the journey and process of player development while promoting American junior and college tennis. Now, they have been around for a while and have some great insight, and Scott joins us to talk about what it's like seeing his own son go through the development of trying to become a D1 tennis player, as well as a professional tennis player, as well as seeing other juniors go through the same process and what American tennis is currently like right now. We also get a little off topic with Wake Forest playing the ITA indoor finals against TCU. So I apologize if we seemed a little distracted. It was a big night for college tennis. Before you guys enjoy this chat with Scott, make sure to check out today's sponsor, the Universal Tennis Power subscription. Not only do you get to see a more detailed number to see where you stack up against your opponents and other players on the UTR Sports website, but you also get power perks. Includes 30% off Tennis Warehouse, 30% off Total Pickleball, 35% off the UTR Shop, 25% off Diadem, $30 off Whoop, and 20% off Print, and so much more. If you are interested in that and you're interested in supporting the podcast and the YouTube channel, make sure to check out the link in the description and the bio of this podcast. And without further ado, here's Scott from the Payers and Players podcast. Welcome to the Tweenerhead Tennis channel, to the podcast, to the, if you're listening to this audio exclusive, I should say, on Your Ball Was Out podcast. If you're watching this as a Tweenerhead Tennis Club member on YouTube, thank you for joining us. I've never seen what Scott has actually looked like up until this point in my life, and I think we've been following each other on Twitter for at least 3 years.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, at least. So, Scott, yeah. Welcome.
Well, Phil, glad to be on. It's like you say, it's good to meet face-to-face. We've known each other, I think it's more than 3 years, but
it really is, to be honest.
Time flies when you're doing this stuff, but it's good to be on your show, and thanks for having us.
Of course. Please, it's my pleasure, and it's always great to talk tennis with people that are in the same space and talk about tennis in the same way we do, and that's why I wanted to have you on, because how long have you been doing Payers and Players, I should say, to start with that?
I think we started 2017. So yeah. Just to give people that aren't familiar with the podcast, Robert Garrett and I started, we're two tennis dads. We both have sons that are now 16 years old. But we met when they were probably 7 or 8 at a tennis tournament. We just sort of became friends. We kept in touch. He had the idea that we start a podcast, talk about some junior tennis stuff. There is, you know, you're probably familiar with Lisa Stone's Parenting Aces. And that was really the only other sort of podcast that was sort of in that niche. Yeah. And I think she does a good job, but we wanted to, you know,
so does my dog, apparently.
What's that?
So does my dog, apparently.
Hey. Yeah. Hey. Otis. Shut up. You done? Okay.
Sorry about that, Scott.
Yeah. And so we thought we had some questions that weren't being addressed just because we were in a different place in our tennis parenting journey at sort of the beginning. And it was sort of a good excuse for us to reach out to people that probably otherwise wouldn't talk to us and pick their brain. So we've had some great guests. We've had, you know, some high level pros. We had Tommy Paul. We've had Diego Moyano, J.Y. Abome, you know, guys that have done a lot in the tennis game that we were able to sort of, you know, connect with them and, you know, make some relationships. So it's been a fun journey. We're getting near the end of the junior journey. Like I said, both our kids are 16, so we're sort of aging out of junior tennis. So we'll see where things go next.
So kind of staying along that line, what have you realized, or what have you adjusted to doing the podcast, seeing your kids grow up together playing junior tennis? What has that journey taught you, not only as a parent, but as someone that covers pro and college tennis?
I think it's what I've sort of noticed in the tennis journey from my perspective is just how the discipline and the hard work ultimately does pay off. And, it's one of the things when you start off, your kid, every kid is developing at a different rate. Some are early developers, some develop later, but ultimately they all get to around the same size and build. But, so there's a lot of things that, my son, he was sort of on the smaller side when he was younger, and now he's 6'3", a bigger kid, taller kid, not necessarily bigger kid, but kids that, were dominating him earlier, now it's the other way around. And so it's just one of those kind of things that, and because he's the only one of my kids that plays tennis, so didn't really have anything to, assess our progress on other than just keep working, just see, just keep doing your best, enjoy the journey, enjoy the process, and you'll get to where you'll get to where you ultimately be, and that's the best you can do. And so I think that was sort of the thing that I've learned so much in this journey is just, having the patience to not worry about short-term results, and there's false positives, false negatives. Sometimes you'd think that, losing to, that match or not having this kind of game is going to hold you back, or it's going to give you a sign of what your real limitations are. And if you don't get caught up in that kind of stuff, you just keep your head down, ultimately, good things will happen.
So for you guys, when you talk about having kids grow up together, ha understanding what it's like to go through this college process, go through this junior professional process of going to all these tournaments, and especially on your YouTube channel with you guys seeing and literally traveling with these kids to different places and experiencing these different cultures and what it's like to be kind of that professional athlete. What is something that's been, what stands out to you the most seeing this journey from a parent's perspective?
I think some of the things that when we started playing tennis that I just never thought we would be doing. Like, for example, like you mentioned, seeing different cultures. I mean, we went to play some ITFs in Colombia last year. I never thought I'd go to Colombia, but, and I never thought that my kid would really like it that much. But he had a great time. He wants to go back. He loved the culture. He made great friends. He's, when you're in an ITF tournament, you've got kids that are going to be from the home country, Colombia, but there's also going to be kids from neighboring countries, Brazil, Argentina, et cetera, and made good friends with those kids, the Argentinian, I'm sorry, the Brazilian kids in particular. And so just having those kind of experiences were really cool. And, I think the thing is when I was trying to, not saying I had a knew what I was doing, but I did want to make his tennis journey fun and special. And that takes a lot of work. It takes, it's no fun to lose, so you've got to work hard. You've got to have some winning. So there's going to be some tough, you don't want the burnout, but at the same time, you want to enjoy the tennis. You want to enjoy the process while you're at the same time maximizing your potential. And I think doing things like playing ITFs in Colombia or Trinidad, it helps with just the burnout. So it's like, it's not the same going to the same tournament, seeing the same kids every tournament, every couple of weeks. So when you have sort of those kind of things that you can point to or you look to, hey, we're working towards, these tournaments, and if you do well in these, that's going to open your door to play some, higher level ITFs here in the States, or you can go play, some, level one tournaments. Those are the kind of things that, you need those motivations. I think it's kind of, you think of some of the kids that, like Trevor and Zach Svida, who didn't play any junior tournaments at all. And, I just think about, how that tennis journey is so different from, say, ours. Now they are in San Diego, and it's a tennis hotbed. They can get away with, training at home and not having to play tournaments. But in Louisville, where we are, every weekend you've got to go somewhere if you want to play, some good level competition. And so, I'm sort of all over the place with this answer, but, but it's all about, for us, it was all about making the journey fun and not burning out, because I think tennis is a sport for a lifetime. And I didn't want him to regret the fact that he became a tennis player.
So how do you prevent that as a parent, or kind of seeing that line of intenseness, right? It's hard to kind of keep up that intensity every single time you play a tournament, you travel, and especially with traveling too. How do you maintain that level of not burning out for your son or for other kids that you coach?
And I should be clear, I'm not a coach. I'm just a tennis parent.
As a tennis parent, how do you provide that? Because I feel like that's another, like, that's a very difficult answer to maintain, right? Because you have to do everything to provide for your parents. And one thing that I've always said is, and what I've learned doing this podcast or doing this channel, I should say, is you have to be able to, coaches have to be able to educate parents on the journey and educate them on what they have to do to provide the best support that they can for their players / their kids, and how to differentiate between being a parent and being what we like to call a helicopter parent, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
as a parent, how do you prevent that, or how do you make your decisions around having someone that's very dedicated to the sport, but also not have them like run out of the sport by the time they're getting into college saying, hey, don't want to do this anymore?
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things is having an end goal that they can see. So like my son, he wants to play college tennis. So we go to the University of Louisville matches. And so when he sees that, he knows that's what he wants to do in college.
Yeah.
So for him to work, he's got to say, okay. And then you, I mean, so we can get into some of the numbers and some of the research I've done, but you know, if, when you want to play at that level, you've got to take it seriously. But he also sees what fun it is for those tennis players, their college experience. He sees that as what he aspires to do in college, not join a frat, not, you know, sort of just go to college and, you know, just be, you know, a regular student. He wants to be a D1 athlete at a big time program. And so to do those things, you've got to commit to it. You've got to sacrifice, you know, some relationships, some activities, some things that you otherwise would do, so you can get there. And I think once the child can sort of visualize what that future looks like, it's a lot easier to buy into the work that's needed to get there. If there isn't this thing at the end of there isn't this reward at the end of the journey, then why do it?
Yeah.
You know? And so, you know, that's, I think, you know, some of the things that we do in terms of going to see college matches just sort of fuels that passion. And, you know, it becomes a little bit more self-driven once he realizes this is what I need to do. I need to be putting in this time. I need to, you know, have this kind of a game or whatever. You know, he sees, and like I said, the good thing is he hits with some of the players from U of L. They're mentors to him. You know, they give him advice. They tell him what he, you know, how, you know, is he acting like a D1 player? Is he acting like a punk? You know, and so it's like a lot better to hear that from them than from me. So, you know, I think those are the kind of things that help in avoiding the burnout. You know, is just sort of knowing that then at the end of the journey, there's a next step. There's something more to it to go on to, not just this is junior tennis and that's just all it's going to be. I think if that was the case, then it would be a little bit more difficult to get motivated to practice, to go to tournaments, to do well, because what's the point?
Yeah. And I like how you put it as not as a end goal or result. It's about the reward that you're able to achieve with it, right? It's not, it's not like you're getting there and that's it. It's your reward is continuing to be a part of the process and continuing to be a part of a college team or playing futures or playing professional tennis. It's the reward is having the opportunity to continue to play. And it's hard to do that because it's always going to be more and more difficult to understand what kids are going through. And I think for you too, seeing that different light or seeing that different perspective? What have you learned personally from this process of being a tennis parent that's stuck with you throughout this journey?
It's a good question, and it's something that, and it, maybe I've hinted at it a little bit earlier, but it's sort of just having the discipline to just do the things 1% each day. It's something that I've learned is that the more consistent you are in your effort and your practice, the results, they do come. And it's like, and I said to earlier, at the beginning, there's so many variables that, go into the success of a tennis player. What creates a good tennis player at 12 isn't necessarily going to be the same thing when they're 16 or 18. And so knowing that, hey, like I said, my son, he was late developer. He's 6'3". He's still got maybe another inch or two to grow, hopefully, but he's probably
Must be
not
nice.
growing. But yeah, it'd be nice to be a 6'5" lefty,
Oh, that's not good. That's going to be recruited.
Right. And so I think just, looking back at, what I learned is it's it, and I don't think I did it too much, but sometimes you'd get discouraged just by how things are going, when he was 10 or 11 years old. And, you see other kids that are doing so well, and a lot of those kids burned out and they're not even there anymore. Some of, like I say, there's a couple of examples of kids that were ranked number one in the 12s, the Southern section. By the time they were 14, they were done with the sport. And so it was sort of that kind of thing is, how do you, it is also about attrition. It's about being able to survive the grind and enjoy the process. And so, some of the things that, I would think back on and just be sort of negative about, oh my gosh, it's not, this is, there's so many kids out here. He's not going to be good enough. What are we doing? Wasting our time. We're driving, 7, 8 hours for a 1200 tournament and, wherever. And it's just, but it's all part of the journey, and it's all the price you pay for where you are.
And that's, I guess that again is the rewarding factor of it. And when it comes to being a part of, let's just say it like this, the tennis parent world is its own little clique. Yes, and while we're also, I have to tell people while you're listening to this or watching this, Scott and I are keeping an eye out on the ITA indoor final. Wake Forest, I believe, just took one of the doubles matches against TCU. Yes. And we're down to two courts for the doubles point. So you're getting a live play-by-play. You're getting a live reaction and commentary on this as well.
Yeah, which will be great when the podcast airs, because the result will already be done. So.
Exactly. So you're going to get live reactions to everything going on. But if we look at or talk about that tennis play, the tennis parent clique, I'm going to put it in that perspective. You've probably seen some things or been a, like, how do you, when you first got into the space, how do you drown out that noise or advice that some parents may give you that may not be the best advice for some other kids?
Yeah, I mean, and that just goes to, every kid, and I think it's one of the things that most tennis parents ultimately learn is that every path is different. Like I mentioned, the Svitas, they didn't even, play tournaments. And everyone else is going to be like, oh, my son, he's a lefty with a one-handed backhand and he's small. It's like, that's a suicide, game plan. And yeah, it's like, yeah, that's dumb. And it's probably not going to be very successful at 11 years old when, everyone's hitting cross court forehands and it's going to your son's backhand, and he's not big. And so it's just, it's not going to be successful. And it wasn't successful. It's gotten better, and it's gotten better because of the fact that it was picked on. That's sort of the same thing that Federer has mentioned. It's like his backhand got better because it was so bad. Everyone picked on it, so he had to get better. So, so everyone's got sort of opinions on, game style and, what you should be doing. And but it's just one of the good things about being in Louisville is sort of a small tennis community, so you don't have a lot of voices in your ear, it may
That's
be a different
fair.
story in, say, Atlanta or New York, where everyone, where there's so many people and they've all got, you know, opinions, and you've got, you know, big fishes and, or I'm sorry, you know, it's a big pond with a lot of small fishes.
Yeah.
Not that, not that the players are small, but it's just there are so many good players, they don't stand out.
Exactly.
Whereas in Louisville, there's only, you know, in the state of
A
Kentucky, there's
handful.
just very, a small handful of people that are committed to the game the way that we are. And so you just sort of do your own thing, and you know, you, like I say, that was the thing about the podcast, was it allowed us to talk to people that really knew what they were talking about and get advice from them, and learn a lot and those kind of things. So yeah, so I mean, you know, I think in terms of like tennis parenting, my probably my best friends are tennis parents. You know, we have a lot more in common than I do with probably my neighbors in the neighborhood. You know, we can talk about, you know, someone's, you know, yard isn't being looking good or whatever, but I don't really care about that. I'd rather talk to somebody about how their kid is doing, and, oh, your kid won a gold ball, you know, this year. That's awesome. Watching these kids grow up, I think it's one of the coolest things, is just seeing kids from, you know, 8 years old, and then seeing them, you know, 8 years later at the Orange Bowl. You know, it's just kind of a really cool journey that, you know, you and especially with social media too, you can sort of just follow along in the journey, and you can, you know, have be excited for kids that are doing well, the kids that are good kids that you've known for years, and it's fun to see them, you know, be passionate about the game that we love and do so well and do things that you just wouldn't think would be possible.
And for kid and for parents too, it's I actually would like to know. Also, there was just a second serve ace from TCU. I'm sorry, I'm just side noting that. What's been the craziest tennis parent story? If we're going to stay along that line, is there one? Because you already took a big sigh for those of you that are just listening to this, because I feel like you may have some stories that, because I definitely have some, maybe not as many as you do, but I've seen some things firsthand, not only as a coach, but as a parent as well. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's the fights, you know, there's you know, the things where, you know, someone overhears somebody talking about their kid and they come up and get in their face. And like at the last tournament here a few months ago, we had the police call because someone got their nose broken.
I'm
So
sorry. No, that's not a normal thing, Scott. We
no,
can't
it's not a
gloss
normal thing.
that
It's
you
not.
can't gloss over that and expect it to be,
Yeah.
oh yeah, by the way, a cop was called because a tennis parent threw hands against another
Yeah.
tennis parent. That's
Yeah. And
why is that? Why
that,
is that a thing?
I mean, I think that the people that were involved are, it's probably more their personalities. So I just think, you know, that just happened. You know, and but I, you know, it's like I would just say that, you know, there's things like that that happen. You know, but I'd say from you know, where we are in the southern section, if people are familiar with the southern section, I don't think it's as crazy as, like, say, Florida is, or maybe New York is. I think that the parents there are a little bit more invested, especially in Florida. Every time that we have like an event with a bunch of Florida kids there, there's just so much drama with line calls, scores, and things like that. And we don't really have that, well, just when the southern section as itself. And also, I think the boys are a little less drama than on the girls' side. I think the girls, for whatever reason, the parents and the girls, there's always a little bit something extra at each tournament about, you know, something going on. So there's it's always there's always there's usually something at each tournament that's kind of worth noting.
So I should just assume that the cops being called after a punch was thrown should be the best story that you have.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have, I mean, there, I'm trying to think if there's anything, you know, else that would maybe come up to that level, but that's probably it. You know, and I think anytime that there's a fight and then there's cops, that's going to be hard to top.
So was the kid thrown out or just the
No,
parents?
the parent was. So, I think that parent is banned for, and I thought it'd be long, but I think it was less 3 or 6 months. So they can't be at tournaments anymore. But there, you know, there's been other incidents where parents have been, you know, banned and everything for saying certain things. And It's just, people just, I think people sometimes they look to be offended and they're very protective of their kids and
Yeah.
things heat up. It's tennis is a, it's an individual sport. And so
Yeah.
you're out there, you're rooting for your kid is, sort of like wrestling or something like that, where, your kids out there by themselves and there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of stress there.
Yeah.
You can't blame your teammates. It's all on you. And I think sometimes it just gets a little bit much for some people.
Does your son let you watch your mat his matches?
Yeah,
Okay.
he records a lot of it. We record a lot of his matches. I try and, if I can, stay at least one court away. I don't want to be on top of his court. I mean, it's
Smart.
not as bad.
That's, ladies and gentlemen, that's a smart tennis parent. That's they know what they need to do in order to avoid that.
Yeah, and
Like,
I mean, I'll roll my eyes. I won't do too much, but
yeah.
he'll see my expression if he does a thing that, and it was, it's probably gotten a lot better just because he's gotten better. So when he wasn't very good, you're sort of like, oh my God, that's your third double fault this game, and so you throw your head back or whatever. And so
The
he sees that.
deep sigh says a lot.
And if you can be, a court away, you can get away with a little bit. You have some of those gestures that aren't as noticeable from a distance. So yeah, always try and stay a little bit further away. Don't always try and be on top of the court. But like I say, I was just saying that, we record, you swing vision to record the matches. And so that sort of takes a lot of the watching the match pressure, because we can go back and we can talk about this later. If you're not recording it, it seems like you've got to sort of live too much in the moment.
Yeah.
And so then you get a little bit, maybe a little bit more, frustrated or excited or whatever. But I think recording the matches helps a lot, because then you can analyze a match after you've had time to cool down. And it's also just fun. He likes to talk about, hey, this point here, can you believe this one? This is what happened, or something like that. And there's always going to be a few highlight type points that you want to watch anyway. So it's always a good idea to record matches when you can.
And do you, shout out to Swing Vision, by the way.
Yeah, for sure.
They're gonna be the sponsor of today's video, which is a good
Okay.
segue to that. Just because you said that. So thank you for
Perfect.
that idea, Scott. TCU just broke back while Wake was serving for the doubles point.
Okay.
Multiple overheads trying to be put away. We got a match. I'm excited.
Yeah. Good.
Let's see. What was the other thing? Do you try to help your son with the video analysis, or do you let him just do that by himself?
A little bit of both.
Okay.
Like, I'll be particularly interested in, like, I'll watch a match and I'll be curious about, oh, how many game points did he have when he didn't win the game? And so, and then what did he do on those points? Because, the margins of chance are so small. So I'd want to go back and just look at those specific things. So when it's when it, when you know and that kind of thing, I'll do most of the, and it's nothing more than me just going through and just making some notes. But then, we'll watch it, and we'll talk about, so then that'll prompt, hey, okay, it's add in, what are you thinking here? What's your play? Here's a kid that, maybe is better than you. Are you playing percentages, or are you going for a home run on every shot? So that's sort of how we do it.
And did you play tennis? Did you introduce your son to tennis?
I grew up in Saudi Arabia, and so we
Oh,
learned
wow.
tennis over there. Yeah. And so not very good. So, like I said, when we moved back to the States when I was, 13 or 14, I was so far behind all the other kids. I wasn't a player at this level at all. But yeah, so I stopped playing tennis for a while and then picked it up. Right before he was born. And then when he got to be, 4 or 5, we just sort of go out to the high school courts and just mess around there for, half hour, whatever, every day, and just sort of became a habit. And
Wow.
then we just kept going with it. So that's how it started.
And now He's 16 and looking to
Yeah.
play college tennis.
Yeah. And, you know, that's, and like I say, that's something that I've done some research on. We can talk a little bit about the opportunities for American juniors.
Yeah.
And it's just not what you'd think it is. I think everyone sort of thinks when they get into it, it's, hey, this is a path. There's not necessarily you're going to be going to, you know, the biggest programs and playing, you know, number one for Texas or whatever. But, you know, you just sort of think that there's a good, you know, there's plenty of spots out there. And when you look at it with all the foreigners and then you sort of break down the numbers, it's really, really a small amount that have a legitimate shot to be even looked at for
Yeah.
some of these top colleges. And, you know, I did a study where I looked at like the top 50 programs. And, you know, so that's, you know, if there's six, you know, starters per team, that's 300 kids.
Yeah.
So that's still a lot, but two-thirds of those are foreign.
Yeah.
And so that means only 100 are American. And there's four, you know, freshman, junior, sophomore, senior. There's four classes. That's only 25 kids per class. So basically, your blue chip recruits on tennis recruiting, that's what top D1 is for. Everyone else is looking for something else. And that's sort of the realization that you're coming to when, you know, you're maybe number 100 as opposed to being, you know, number 10.
Yeah.
You know, your options just aren't what you might have thought they were going to be when you started the, you know, when you started this thing, thinking that, oh, if I can be top 100, surely there's a place for me. But it's
Yeah.
not necessarily the case. So
And the reason why
that's,
I'm looking up to, and sorry to cut you off, because I'm trying
yeah.
to, I know exactly what tweet you are talking about too, because I saw that that actually got a lot of traction online because of the percentage of which Americans were getting the opportunity to play, right?
Yeah.
And where are we? Where are we? Where are we? I'm going to try to find this right now. Give me it. Give me it. Because, and I'm also giving, just as a buffer, I'm also giving Scott the opportunity to watch the doubles match. Because they are trying to stay in the match with whatchamacallit, with serving
Let's
for
say
this. Did they tie it up?
TCU is, oh, it's match point or it's a doubles point
Oh, it's doubles. Oh,
for weight.
we gotta pause the whole thing.
Yeah. Oof.
Is that it? Yep.
Oh my God.
Oh,
Holy cow. A reflex off the swinging volley. So we're at a deuce point now. Wow.
something just happened, though.
Uh-oh, Brian Baker's in trouble.
I don't know if he's in trouble or live reaction to this is
Well,
podcasting
somebody got
right
a point
here.
penalty because now it's five all. So there was a point penalty.
On TCU, I think, right?
No, I'm wake.
For
Because they
what?
have, yeah. Because it would have been deuce point, and now it's five all.
Jesus Christ. That's wild.
Yeah.
All right. If I can find, I'll find this. I'll eventually find this. I'll eventually find this, but we'll come back to it while I'm scrolling here, while we're calling out the live scoring for the doubles. But yeah, I think you brought up a really good point when you guys tweeted that out, because we look at American tennis and it's great. There's so many kids that are playing this sport and there's so many kids that are getting looked at for colleges. The problem is when we go to top programs, over 50% of the roster is probably international, or some are
Oh.
even fully international.
Yeah, and yeah, here's
Did you find it?
yeah, I'm sending it to you.
Let's see.
Yeah, and yeah, there, like I say, there's some schools and some conferences that do rely heavily on American players, like the Patriot League. You know,
Yeah.
you got your armies and your navies, but also a lot of the other schools They seem to have a lot of Americans than other school, other conferences. Ironically, Conference USA by name has
Yeah.
like four American players in the entire conference. It's something ridiculous. And you know, and then the thing is you're right. The junior tennis is good. The level in America is good. It's, you know, it's maybe not as great as say Europe, but so what? You know, this is not professional tennis. College tennis is not, it's not supposed to be, but it is de facto professional tennis now. And that's taking away opportunities for good American kids. Well, they're just not good enough. And I used
Yeah.
to think that, hey, if you're not good enough or you're just not good enough and you know nobody has a right to play college tennis and they should, you know, whatever. I just don't know if I believe that. You know, talk we had Wayne Bryan on the podcast, father of the Bryan brothers, and he was, I mean, he made the point to us, and that really hit home with me, is it's like you are good enough. You are there. American kids are good enough,
Yeah.
but they've turned college tennis into professional tennis. Yeah, these kids, they're not professional players. They're not going to be 1500 in the world ATP,
Yeah.
but they can play at, you know, Boise State or somewhere.
They can
Now
play
they're
a
not
high
even.
level mid Mountain West, Big Sky. They can play a high level at a
Yeah,
smaller school.
right. And so that's sort of where the direction is, but it's getting harder because I mean those college coaches are paid to win. They're not paid to recruit Americans. They're not paid to be good guys or whatever. They're paid to win matches. And when the top programs look at Texas, a 23-year-old freshman from France, you know, when that's who you're competing against, you've got to
23
go
year
out
old
and get.
freshman from France.
Yeah,
Saying
you have
that
to
out
work.
loud is scary.
Yeah. And you know, Wake's roster, you know, they have four players that are 23 years old or older. You know, it's
It's the
really nuts.
oldest, it's one of the oldest. I think Parsons tweeted out yesterday.
Yeah.
It's the one of the oldest starting six rosters in college tennis, where four of them were 22 plus.
Yeah. 23 plus.
23, even
Yeah,
better.
even better. Yeah.
Even better.
Yeah, you got a 20, you have a 25-year-old guy that's playing doubles for him. And so it's just it, you know, they're finding ways to push the envelope. And I'm not saying they're breaking any rules, but is this what college tennis is supposed to be? And I
Yeah.
don't think it, I don't think so. I mean, when we have Americans that play college tennis, you're going to get a lot more people in the stands. It's going to be a lot more, you know, crowd involvement. You know, some schools, they just do not do a good job of promoting the program. And that's because they've got six foreigners starting and nobody in the community knows who they are. They're going to be gone in a year. They're going to, you know, they're going to come in, they're going to leave and make no real impact other than, you know, the record books in the on the, you know, stat page for this for the school. That's, you know, that's.
And I think what you bring up too is a double-edged sword, right? It's you want to bring in players that can win. You want to bring in players that can make an impact on the program. You want a lasting impression with who you recruit. And your job is not just to coach, it's to build a program as well. So when you have guys that are newer to the culture in the United States, that are newer to the whole way college tennis is done because they're coming over from, playing juniors and playing tournaments by themselves to going as a team and playing for a school where they have to balance academics. So it's always going to be tougher for someone from France or Italy or Brazil to blend in with the college tennis environment, but they have to learn how to adapt to it so that way they can build that program. And it's not just about the players, it's about how they advertise the program as well. And that comes down to coaches, in my opinion, because you can be a really good promoter and you can be a really good philanthropist in terms of raising money for a program, but then you may not be as strong as a coach. It's hard to find the balance of both. So when it comes
Yeah.
to American players that are playing for top teams, you're gonna really have to recruit them because there's no more a dime a dozen. Because if they are playing, they're going to top programs for NIL money. And that's just another
Right.
topic within itself of how much players are getting now just to transfer. I mean, the biggest.
Well, and I think that that's a real incentive for more foreigners to come into, American college tennis, because not only are they getting free training, free coaching, potentially free education. I'm not sure what the scholarship situations are going to be, but they're also, I think internationals can now get NIL. They, I know some players for a fact that are international that did get paid, that were in the transfer portal. So, it's just becoming more, and I think this is all around college sports, football and basketball. You're seeing it, huge numbers being thrown around. And yeah, they those gener those programs, sports bring in huge amounts of money. That makes I sort of get it that. Tennis doesn't really bring in money unless you have donors, unless you have a good coach that or have a coach that can go out and raise funds and generate the revenue so they can have that budget to go out and get players. That's just where it's going. And
But that,
those colleges are interested in developing professional players, and that's their MO, is to get the best players in there. And those best players are going to be probably professionals.
and the I will say the revenue part, tennis for a fact is a non-revenue sport for college programs, right? Oh my God, Wake Forest just took the doubles.
Wow, from Love 40.
Yeah. Off a missed backhand volley into the net.
Wow. Got to find out what
Also,
happened at 5-4.
jeez.
Need to go back and see what happened there. All right, so as you're saying.
For in terms of, let's just say, in terms of non-revenue sports, tennis is the hardest part about this is tennis will most likely be. A lot of smaller programs will probably be cut because of how impactful NIL deals and programs are going to be if they're prioritizing different sports. So it's always going to be harder for a small tennis program, let's say in the A10, that has a really good basketball team and they need to prioritize NIL. If they don't have a very successful tennis program or they're not generating enough revenue, what's going to happen?
Yeah,
It's
I mean,
most likely going to be cut.
how many programs generate any money? Nobody charges ticket price. Very few schools charge admission to get in. Everything probably is just through fundraising if they do have any sort of revenue. How many of those programs are at least break even? Very few, very, very few. So you're right. It's gonna be very interesting to sort of see where the college tennis landscape is in 3 or 4 years. I suspect it'll be very different than where it is right now.
It already is.
And I don't think it'll be better.
I think it'll be better, but I think it's going to be. I think one of the hardest things about it is seeing whether or not college tennis is always going to be the best pathway for junior players. And that's just another conversation where I feel like, depending on the program, you can get a really good. You can get really good players that develop at certain schools, like a TCU program, like a Wake Forest program that we're watching right now, that have shown that they can produce pro level players. And I think that still, and every player that I've interviewed and talked to, still in their home country, they still have the notion of college tennis is still looked at as giving up on their pro dreams, which is not the case at all.
No, it's
Because
not. And I think, looking back maybe 6, 7 years ago when there were maybe three college players in the top 10, now there's like 20. And so, if 20% took a pathway through college tennis, that's definitely a viable pathway. I don't think it has that stigma anymore. Obviously, guys like Fonseca and, guys like that, they don't need it. But, he's, a rarity. But most players, they can use a year. The kid at Virginia, Jodar, You know, he's probably not gonna stick around, but I mean, he's,
He's
you know, he
killing
won
it.
Junior US, he won Junior US Open, and now he's killing it at UVA. And I don't know if he'll be around long, but I mean, he definitely saw the value in coming for at least a year and getting the training, getting the coaching, getting the you know, matches, because every match he's playing is against a challenger level player type player. So he's getting good quality matches.
And that's in that too. Even if we look at Alex Mitchelson, Ethan Quinn won in one national championship left. So it really just depends. And I think when we look at the overall, if we move on kind of along that lines of American tennis and college tennis, let's just say that as well. What did you think of the US Open changing its policy for the wild card to the for college tennis kids? I thought that was just that was such a crap move.
Well, I mean, I think college tennis sort of did that to itself by moving to the fall. I think it
Yes,
gave,
I agree.
and so I think it opened the door for them to re-examine how we want to do this. But I do think that they still have a wild card, but it's going to be a playoff in
It's
the
a
summer,
tournament
right?
itself. It's a tournament itself, which
Right, but it's for only college players, right?
only college players and only Americans. So
Yeah, so I
we
mean,
could
I.
have three international kids on the top three, and then it's like, oh, never mind. We're gonna have the next three playing for a spot.
Right, but at the end of the day, it will guarantee a spot for an American college player, whereas the previous system did not, because if, say, Petros Chrysoukos won it, nobody got the wild card. So now at least somebody in college does get the wild card, even though it's a little bit different. I mean, I've always sort of been under the impression that, you know, if you make college tennis better, if you're from Cyprus or you're from the US, then you should be eligible for that wild card. And I thought it was kind of lame that we did not give it to foreigners, but now it's something, now it's completely different, and so it's a different situation. So
It shows too how I think after even I'm gonna butcher this name so badly, Fangren Tian. Tian
oh,
Fangren,
okay,
the
that's
Chinese
her.
girl that won NCAAs, like even with some of them too, like, or even Paul Jubb or even Dasha that won, like they're not going to get an opportunity to play because they're not representing the United States. So it's we, but again, I get
No,
it
that
because it's the USTA and you're trying to keep it in-house in that retrospect, but it's always going to be hard doing that because it's always going to be hard. That's plain and simple. Can you hold on one second? I have to plug in my charger. This is riveting podcasting. Multiple interruptions and following a college tennis match at the same time. This is awesome.
Yeah, stop working. Take a over. Yeah, I'm looking at you. Oh, UConn's winning. Oops.
All right. Where were we?
We're talking about the US Open wild card.
That was and also one of the things too, if we go along those lines, and I've talked about this with Nate from Not Your Country Club, but moving the individuals to the fall is maybe not the right choice.
No, it's
It's really sanctioning off players from pursuing of pro tennis
yeah.
and their ability to play college tennis at the same time, especially the top ones. That's why we didn't see a
Right.
lot of the top guys play individuals this year because they're
Yeah,
all playing pros.
and the entry process with the various tournaments, that everyone had to play, and it was very, very weird and hard to follow fall. And I think a
Messy.
lot of people
The
just
word is
lost
messy.
interest.
It's messy because no one knew what to follow or when to follow it.
And I like to say, I like to think that I follow it pretty closely, but I
Yeah.
didn't follow it at all. I didn't had no interest. And I get it that the fall, the individual tournament after the team tournament makes
Yeah.
it for a long couple of weeks for a couple of guys. But at the same time, we were in Stillwater last year, and sort of for the last, for the final, for the fi semifinals and finals, all the players from all the individual players that didn't play the team event, they flew in, coaches, it became like a really big scene.
Yeah.
You're not going to have that this year in Waco in the spring.
Yeah.
The only people that are going to be there are going to be the two teams, and that's about it. But not even that many fans. I mean, I don't think in Stillwater there were that many fans of TCU in Texas, which wasn't that far from Stillwater. I mean, that's pretty
No.
close. And they still didn't, there wasn't a big contingency of, people that weren't family, people that weren't on the team, as there as spectators.
Yeah.
And so I think having all those players there at least gives you the feel, because everybody was there watching the match. It was kind of cool just bumping into, players from all the colleges,
Yeah.
hanging out, watching the match and everything. You're going to lose that vibe at this year's spring champ, spring team, which would be eight teams. Once
Yeah.
teams lose, they're out of there, and
Yeah.
that last day could be pretty empty, which is not a good look.
I wouldn't even say it's a not a good look, but it's also it doesn't maybe it's a good thing for players because they had such a long season, they're finally done. But it also doesn't allow the same vibe as to having everyone on campus. Let's just say, excuse me. Because it doesn't allow that same, doesn't allow the same energy. Like watching this ITA indoors for me, and I told you this earlier before we started recording, or even at, right at the beginning. But this watching this has given me so much. Like it's been so electric to play and watch. Like that's the energy that we want in college tennis, and that's what we. I even went on a little snippet, like a little rant yesterday on Twitter about it because I was so excited about watching it. And we compare that to professional tennis. It's
Oh,
always going to be hard. It's unless you get a big player, that's going to be like,
it's always different watching a team than an individual player.
yeah.
We can watch, Federer, but you're not going to have the same level of interest or passion. Because, like I say, when you've got multiple matches going on and it all means that one team is going to win, however
Yeah.
these individuals do, it just means more. And it
Yeah.
just, there's just a little bit more drama. There's more energy. There's the players are, chanting. It's so much more than any sort of professional type tournament, no matter the level. I mean, the
Yeah.
level here is insane,
Yeah.
but it's still not quite, where
Refined.
professionals are.
Yeah.
But who cares? It's a
Yeah.
great product.
Yeah.
I don't care that, these guys aren't, they're ranked, 400 in the world. I don't care if they're ranked 5, 5,000 or whatever.
Yeah.
If it's at least as a minimum quality, then
Yeah.
it's all good. It's to me, it's just the format really, and just the youth and the
Yeah.
excitement, everything about college tennis is great.
Yeah.
So
No, I agree. And I actually wanted to ask you this question, just came to my mind. When your son plays tennis, and I guess I keep using him as the example because you're a tennis parent and you've seen him go through this process. Would you ever want your son to go pro in tennis and see that?
Well, and see what
And see how he does, or like see him get through everything.
I mean, I guess pro tennis chooses you. You don't choose it. So if he's good
Interesting.
enough, yeah. So I mean, that's not where my aspirations are for
Okay.
him. My it's really college tennis is what I'd like him to do. And like I say, then if he's good enough to give it a go, then yeah, go ahead, you know, go ahead. But it's hard, you know. We see a lot of guys that are out there, and it's a struggle, you know. It's guys that, you know, were, you know, top, you know, in their class, you know, top, you know, number one juniors in the world, and everything. When they get out there without coaches, on their own, they don't have support, you know, they're not doing the right things in terms of practice, nutrition, etc. It's hard to get out of that. And, you know, so that's, again, why college tennis is so appealing to so many players, is because it gives you some structure, gives you that coaching, gives you that mentality that, you know, you're doing this. And when some guys don't have that, it's a real, you see that they really struggle. They have the talent, but they're just not doing as well as they could be doing, I think. And so, yeah, I mean, if my son, you know, when, if his level ever gets that high, it'd be interesting, but that's not what we're thinking at all right now.
Is that something that, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this, because is that something that you could see, or is that something that coaches try to push on kids to like play better, or to like make them train harder or go to these tournaments that they don't need to? Is that kind of like a false reality that some, as a tennis parent, that you've seen coaches use?
That if you need to do this, if you want to become a pro kind of thing? I don't know. It could be at some of the academies. But like I said, my son doesn't really have a coach. We just sort of do our thing. He hits with some players, and we don't really get a lot of advice, to be honest, from anybody.
Okay.
So I don't really know if that's something that is used, but I mean, you know, I could say, I think of some examples, you know, the changeover guys, Jody and Evan and Justin, you know, they train a lot of Axis, the tennis academy, which also has a lot of juniors. So, I mean, I'm sure that that environment for those kids is training like a pro, and the expectation is that that's where they'll be in when they're 23, 24, whatever. So I'd imagine at a place like that, the mentality and the motivation is professional tennis and things like that. So,
And I think, Scott, I can't thank you for coming on again. And I really do appreciate you coming on to talk about tennis and talk about everything in terms of your knowledge and everything. And I feel like we could talk for literally another hour, but I know it's late, and we could do our live coverage of the TCU Wake Forest men's match.
Won't be very interesting tomorrow.
No, it won't. And especially if we do it all audio based and we have nothing, if we don't have the stream up as well. But Scott, I really appreciate you taking time out of your night and to finally come on the channel and come on the podcast, I should say, and to talk everything tennis and talk about your journey. Would love to have you back on sometime soon to talk about everything. And if you don't follow Scott on Payers and Players, also, by the way, great name for your podcast. I love it. It's actually a fantastic name. How did you come up with that again?
There is a tennis documentary called 50,000 Balls. Are you familiar with it?
No.
And so it's you know who TJ Pura is?
Yes.
Duke tennis?
Yes.
So TJ's dad did a documentary of TJ when he was 12 years old and three other kids as they were going to the national, you know, play national hard courts.
Yeah.
One of the coaches said, you know, that in tennis, there are payers and then there are players. So the parents are the payers and the kids are the players. And so that's who you've got to.
That's incredible.
That's who this coach had to, you know, adjust his coaching to. He's coaching both the payer and the player. So
that's incredible.
That's where we got that from. So, you know, I just love that movie. If you haven't seen that documentary,
what's it called?
Balls, 50,000 Balls.
50,000 Balls. All right. I'm going to type that in. So
it's really good. And you see, you'll when you watch it, you'll be seeing a lot of players that you'll recognize when they're 12 years old. So it's a fun watch.
Okay. I'm trying to 50,000 Balls.
I think you can get it on Vudu or something like that. VUDU.
Oh, Vudu, yeah.
Yeah, that's where it is on for available
Ooh.
for streaming.
Okay.
Phil, thanks. Like I say,
No.
it's been great. Yeah, like I say, I know that we've communicated over the years, and so it's great to finally do this. Hopefully, we'll get together and see each other in person at some point. But
Yeah.
until then, appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you, Scott, so much. Make sure to follow Scott on all his social medias, Instagram, X/Twitter, Payers and Players, and make sure to check out their podcast as well. They have a lot of great guests, and even their YouTube channel has some great vlogs from their times traveling with the kids and seeing what they go through on a day-to-day basis when they travel to these ITFs. Scott, thank you
Appreciate
again so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
it. Who's gonna win, Wake or TCU?
I'm putting it away.